Okay, this is session 15, August 28, 2006, side one. And we're doing, continuing on page 25 of my book. We're doing the McLuhan pages. And let's go with a quote from, let's look it up, JQ is the index code. Looking it up, it's from an essay McLuhan wrote in, or got published in 1951. In a Catholic journal called, a literary critical journal called Renaissance, Volume 4, Number 1. And the essay is called Joyce Aquinas and the Poetic Process, and it's page 5 of that. Okay, you want to read the quote?
Any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a, quote, minotaur, which must be slain by the hero artist. Anything which interferes with cognition, whether concupiscence, pride, imprecision or vagueness, is a minotaur ready to devour beauty. So that Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stages of apprehension and the creative process, he was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend. And thus he will to incorporate at every point in his work the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception.
Yeah, now this is a really important quote. Is there anything you want to say about it first that strikes you?
I want to start commenting on it, and I'll jump in.
Okay, so he writes another criticism, and in this, about how Joyce, his idea of beauty was not emerging with the object of beauty or the inspiration. It was a strategy of detachment. And looking at the balance between the proportions of the beauty and in relation to his own perception, to his own senses. And so we have here, the previous quote was about, we have on page 25, is Daedalus was the first to note the relation that all artistic imitation, or from Greek culture on what we call art, was an imitation of the pagan liturgies or rituals or mysteries. And so he says, if Daedalus was the first to note this relation, Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. Now he's, in this quote we're just reading now, he restates that. The first quote was from Interior Landscape, 1969, but it was an essay, it was an essay on Joyce by McLuhan, written in 1953. So this quote about Daedalus, which is above the quote you read, was written 2 years after the quote we're reading from right now. But you link the two things to explain this connection McLuhan's making about the stages of apprehension. So you have, Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stages of apprehension and the creative process, he was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend. So human ritual, myth, and legend were the ancient mysteries that were particularized and made into visual artifacts known as painting and sculpture and music, the traditional fine arts, which really got going on the individualist humanist level with Greek culture in 500 B.C., we call that art, but that art was based on the tribal preliterate rituals. So Joyce is saying the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend was the drama of cognition, the drama of perception, and how we take in data from the sensory, from the world, and then our senses convert it, mutate it, and then recreate an image of the world. And also the world imposes its forms on us. So this dialectic between what we make and what the world imposes on us and what we impose back and project on the world. That drama of cognition of, and we'll take that as the individual body making that drama of cognition, that comes out of the Greek emphasis on the individual, not the tribal, but that the individual drama of cognition is a replay of what the preliterate people were doing with a group mind, where they would make sure the sun came up every day, and the tribe was responsible for the sun to come up. They were very participatory in the universe. So the participatory collective nature of tribal reality and their art form, which was ritual, that becomes a metaphor for how we perceive the world. We make the world as well as match with it. So he's saying that the drama of cognition is the archetype of the preliterate activity. So you have preliterate activity and ritual and liturgies and mysteries acted out by the tribe or groups within the tribes. Daedalus sees that art comes from that, then, which is like the external object. And then Joyce sees that the making of the art, the sensory drama of cognition that goes into making the art form, is a replay of the activity that the art object imitated, and that activity was the human rituals of preliterate society, right?
Yeah.
So Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stages of apprehension and the creative process, that's like the drama of your own sensory life and how you come up with an idea. I'm going to go back to that. He was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend. This is more important than the archetypes of Jung, according to McLuhan. And Joyce felt that way. This was a bigger discovery. And so I'm explaining that part of the sentence. Now I'm going to go to the first part, or that part of the paragraph. Now the first part of the paragraph, where he says, any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur which must be slain by the hero artist. You know, the famous world of the labyrinth, and the minotaur is there to devour you if you don't get your act together in relation to the minotaur, right?
In relation to finding your way through the labyrinth, I guess.
Yeah, you got to find your way out of the labyrinth, or you'll be devoured by the minotaur.
So you're in the labyrinth, and you know there's a minotaur. You know you got to find your way out, and you hope that you find that your way out before you find the minotaur.
Yeah. Now, a literal presentation of that is like some monster, and it's going to eat you.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. But that is a metaphor for the way to get perception on the world, a balanced perception that is not involved with the medium around you, which is your normal sensory activity, and in traditional terms is identifying with concupiscence, pride, imprecision, or vagueness. That identification with the world around you, that is, to get detached from that, is a miming of the old story of not being slain by the monster. So in a way, the drama of the movement of appetite is the operation of sensory life on you, which, you know, the Buddhists call, or the Hindus call, Maya, or an illusion. Now that's partly what Joyce is saying, but he says just seeing the world as illusion and ignoring it or transcending it is not enough, from Joyce's point of view, to have a real perception of the world. And so it would lean towards Thomas Aquinas' ideas, which were not looking at the world as illusion. The Christian idea is that this world is real. But how do you relate to it? So there's a simple cliche statement, a Christian is in the world but not of it. That's a simple statement of what we have here, where the hero artist is looking at the world around him, not making any pro or con value judgments, but is seeing the forms of it and the lay of the land, so to speak. And then because he isn't identifying with it, he can replay it in his art form very accurately, which then works on other people who explore the art form that the artist made. So it's this detachment. And that was interesting. I need to say this before. Remember what you're going to say. But an interesting subtle thing that no one would say is that if you read McLuhan's article in The Interior Landscape, written in 1953, the book came out in 1969, a collection of his essays, you will see that in his essay on Wyndham Lewis, he talks about how Lewis did not identify with the flux of existence. And so, on some subtle level, this is McLuhan being Lewisian in talking about Joyce, and Joyce and Lewis do not see eye to eye on the surface of things. So that Lewis accused Joyce of identifying with the world about him.
Mm-hmm.
The time philosophy of Einstein and other phenomena in the early 20th century. And Lewis was a great critic of Joyce's identifying with his time, or of his medium, or of his day, or of the labyrinth of the early 20th century. So that may not be what Joyce was doing, but Lewis felt that. And McLuhan was heavily influenced by Lewis. And so in a sense, he's projecting a Lewisian definition of what the artist should do on Joyce. all right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a subtlety that's for postgraduates of McLuhan. Just dealing with the words, maybe Joyce was like Lewis, or they agreed, in the sense that they are not identifying with the flux of existence and all its sensory pleasures or its sensory beauty. It is another more detached view. It's not a romantic view. It's not an inspirational view. It's a technical view like a scientist.
Yeah.
Okay, what were you going to say?
Well, there's still identification going on. You could say you're not identified, but then try stopping breathing for 5 minutes, and you'll find you're pretty identified.
Yes, but if you're more sensitive to the operation, you're getting to 2 degrees of subtle detachment. For example, when I spoke to James Joyce, or an entity claiming he was James Joyce, with the Evergreens, or through the Evergreens in January 1995, I did an hour session with the spirit of James Joyce, or something claiming they're James Joyce, and at one point, I had done 4 sessions that day, and I don't know if I was on the 3rd or 4th session, but I'm doing this, and I haven't eaten in a long time. While I'm talking to him, and Michael's in trance, Michael Blake Reed, the medium, channeling the Evergreens, my stomach growled, okay? Just a slight stomach hunger growl. You know, you'd think it was just, I don't think anybody would hear it. Well, Joyce was describing how he wrote Finnegan's Wake, and he was explaining how he would write down the effects of the sensory world around him. And he was, like, writing down what was going on in the moment. And as he's describing this, he goes, you heard that growl of your stomach that you just emitted? I said, yeah. And I said, you heard that? He said, yeah. And he says, I would incorporate that momentary thing into my writing.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If he was writing and his stomach growled, he'd write that in. He was registering all his sensory activity.
Yeah.
Not just his thinking. Now, that to me is a fine, like, technical scientific detachment in relation to your body process and your sensory cognition. You know, you're registering like a meter anything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That to me smacks of a kind of detachment. The other remarkable thing was that I don't know if Michael Blake Reed heard it. He's definitely asleep, it seems, when he's in trance. But it showed that Joyce, the spirit, was right inside myself and could hear the stomach. That was pretty amazing in itself. That was kind of an ESP, just like when Uspensky reports Gurdjieff being inside him. Remember that story?
Right.
I felt that was a similar thing, because it's a very subtle little noise, and the Evergreen.
Yeah, if Michael was awake, you don't think he could have heard it, just only you would have heard it.
It might have been louder than I realized, because I wasn't, you know, it was a very quiet room. It was just Michael sleeping, ostensibly sleeping, and his wife, and we're just talking to the spirits. So that was, I would assume it wasn't that loud. But Michael might have heard it. But
right.
The next point is, though, is that the way, if it was Michael, he was a genius, because he was incorporating exactly what McLuhan says Joyce did.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when Joyce said that he would write in the growl, I sort of understood that. I already knew that about Joyce,
mm-hmm.
having gotten it from the way McLuhan interpreted Joyce. You know what I mean? So it got borne out right in front of me. And so then you come to this last sentence of this paragraph. Excuse me. And thus Joyce, or he, was able to incorporate at every point in his work the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception. That growl was the slightest current of perception.
Yeah.
It was a little sensory thing that I perceived. And so he incorporates the whole body of the past, all the cultural history that the 20th century had access to and could retrieve. He took that and made it a metaphor in relation to the little sensory things that he was experiencing, you know, in his room when he was writing.
Right.
So there it is right there. And so
it's interesting
back,
that he could attain to that. I would think that the only way to attain to that awareness would be to be, like, you know, an expert meditator. But
yeah,
he was a literary
good.
He was a literary guy. He was using his brain to read books and develop his literary imagination. I wonder how that led to developing such an acute awareness of the present.
Ah. You think that he became a writer by reading? No, that's the illusion. That's the cultural bias. He became a writer because he was like a yogi studying his senses. In the famous passage, I think it's about page 44 of Ulysses, where Stephen Dedalus is walking on the strand, the beach, you know, along the coast of Dublin, just outside the city or whatever, wherever it is, and he's going along and he's studying his senses. The famous passage is called the diaphany, D-I-A-P-H-A-N-E, and he goes to the diaphany of the visual and the transparency or diaphany of the acoustic. And he's analyzing his senses. That's right in the Ulyssian thing. So, yes, you think a yogi is ignoring media and books, and often, and like in a John Lilly sensory deprivation tank, he's in his cave meditating and studying his body process and his astral process. You don't associate that with reading. But Joyce put the two together. I mean, he was interested in all the cultures and religions and esoteric traditions of the world. So, and he was interested in the Blavatsky movement. I mean, that's partly why he dated Ulysses as June 16th, 1904. Not only was it the date he had his first date with Nora, it also was 19 years after the founding of the Theosophical Society in Dublin on June 16th, 1885. Mm-hmm. That's not a very well-known fact. So there was that theosophical metaphor. And there's all kinds of that stuff is embedded in Ulysses because it was part of Dublin life when Joyce was growing up. So the so then he puts that into the content of the book, and that's probably why people thought his books were gross and obscene, because he was putting so many of the body processes in Ulysses. Mm. That's why it was hard to get published.
I wonder if he viewed,
and it was censored. Remember,
I wonder,
so he was doing a yoga.
I wonder if he viewed words as being sensory processes.
Oh, that was the point. That was the Pound, Lewis, and Eliot were beginning to see media as food, as body processes. That's where the idea of the medium as a message comes from. It's from McLuhan's studies of that. And you really see it in Lewis. And Joyce was reading Lewis, and they all were getting inspired by Lewis. And McLuhan then applied that collectively. They only laid it out as a artistic phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, McLuhan expanded it to the global theater. He always said that his work was applied Joyce, and this is why I'm sticking this in here, because it's an important part of leading up to the media ecology that we're going to be talking later, you know, when we get into page 30 in that, 35, yeah. When we get into that section of the quotes that are coming. So let's go back. I think it's
Well, the thing I'm not clear about here is he's saying that the apprehension of cognition that arises, that doing an Indian rain dance is an archetype of the creative process, the apprehension of the drama of cognition. And then he's saying, but then in literate times, the drama of cognition is very different from doing an Indian rain dance. So I don't get how they're both the same thing.
Yeah, you don't get the Daedalus insight. That to note that the art was a replay of an imitation of the original process. Well, if you look at art as making, and making sense of the world and of your culture or wherever you are, whatever experience you're trying to understand or get out of the labyrinth of and technically replay accurately, it becomes an individual abstract thing under literate conditions.
Hmm.
Ideas enter into it. Whereas the pre-literate people, they felt they had to make the world. So the making done by the tribe now becomes done in the individual state of mind.
Mm.
And when you're living in a literate society for hundreds of years, you may forget that your art object is a replaying of pre-literate situations. And so at some point, someone had to point that out, and it's the god Daedalus, or the mythical legend of Daedalus.
Right.
He was the first to do that. If you interpret this whole process that way, and Joyce, under the impact of the Golden Bough and all that anthropology that was coming in at the end of the 19th century, they started to look at the pre-literate world, and they came up with ideas like this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
now the attempt,
a little better?
Yeah, the desire to understand the world through rain dance or through studying mathematics seems like this understanding that human beings are attempting to arrive at is always one step off one step away from being graspable.
Yeah.
I think somebody told me that it was Tim Leary or somebody that said that people on psychedelics often feel like they're just on the verge of some final conclusive understanding of everything, but that final conclusive understanding is always moving one step off in infinite.
Yeah,
regression beyond their ability to grasp it.
It's asymptotic in math. You never get to the.
It's never attained.
You never touch the border.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. That drama. I mean, Alan Watts used to talk about, you can't see the thing that does the seeing. You can't hear the thing that does the hearing. That's the. In other words, you can't translate. If you define the thing that does the hearing, the organ, the root of consciousness, as tactility. That's why tactility is not a sense. You can't translate it into one of the senses. And when a person's brain is trying to understand something, they're trying to get a comprehensive view of it, and you can't do it in one sensory mode.
Yeah.
And so that process has been externalized, McLuhan says. That very psychological, whatever you want to call it, perceptual psychological fact, became a collective environment with television. Television, he said, extended the human mystery of consciousness, collectively. So it's important that you bring up that point, is that understanding that you can get the point, once you get that detachment, that subtle detachment, which is not totally escaping detachment, but you're inside the experience of not able to get the final point, but when you understand that consciousness will not allow you get to there, then you're a little more relaxed about the intensity of trying to get there, and then you get a balance, and then you can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when you take LSD, that intensifies the psychological process. And so it becomes a big drama trying to understand it, and you're getting lost in the effect of the chemical intensification of LSD, and you don't need... It would exaggerate that incompleteness. Remember, Krishnamurti said, the truly religious person is incomplete. And that's a great statement. When you understand that in this human condition, you cannot get it, once you really understand that, then you're on the edge of getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the drama of cognition. That's a drama trying to get the final statement. And then, so you hear it, then you're putting it into the subvocal or to the verbal.
Well, is the final statement attainable if you realize tactility or whatever it is you need to realize?
You can't. You realize why it's unattainable, because you're trying to sub-vocalize it and put it back into the acoustic, and that would limit it. That would put it into one sensory mode.
Mm.
It's all the senses in interaction.
Oh, yeah, which was what the space that Joyce was trying to attain and write from.
He worked from that space, and therefore he was balanced in the labyrinth, but he began to realize that our technology externalized that process. So just as LSD is man-made, so it's a human-made thing, and it was a little pill that intensified that drama of trying to get it all and not being able to get to it, that was a chemical body version of how we'd reached that point with radio and television, where we have access to all this information, but you can't visualize it.
Mm-hmm.
And so TV especially, since it includes all the senses, not just eye and ear, it is the complete extension of what consciousness is like, and therefore it's an extension of that mystery as a drama right in front of us. So what happens if that's the formal fact of television? Then we have nothing but all kinds of informational content. All attempts to, it's like the whole population is on acid, and they're looking and having hallucinatory images as they try to get the final statement of what it is, the final big insight, however form it manifests, and we never get there. If you understand that, that's why McLuhan says you have perpetual unstoppability in the TV environment.
Mm-hmm.
Until you realize that television is an extension of that tactile incompleteness, you will be lost in the information data trying to find the secret answer.
Yeah. And so each of the senses has its own desires. So if
yes.
You
Yeah.
Seduced by the eye or seduced by the ear, that's the minotaur that then pulls you out of the state of wholeness.
Yeah, the tactile comprehensibility of the incompleteness of consciousness.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the next quote, page 27, and see if these relate. I intended them to relate. Well, see if I was successful.
Okay.
The next quote is from Cliched Archetype. The next few quotes are going to be from the book From Cliched Archetype, which came out in 1970, and McLuhan worked on it for several years with Wilfred Watson, who was a Canadian poet who had won the Governor General's Award for Poetry back in the 50s. And T.S. Eliot.
The next quote is W.W. What's that?
No, that's Marsh McLuhan and Wilfred Watson. Oh, see the C.A.?
Yeah.
Go up a line. C.A.
The next quote is Aristotelian Mimesis.
Yeah. And it ends with the word nature. And then you have CA-MMWW-149.
Okay, I got you.
So that CA means it refers to the 1970 book From Cliched Archetype.
Right.
Just for the listener, all the quotes have a little code that you go at the back of the book and find out where the source is, which is an index of the codes.
Right.
Which is just abbreviations of the titles and the initials of the authors. So the author of the book, From Cliched Archetype, two authors, Marsh McLuhan and Wilfred Watson. And as I was saying, Wilfred Watson was a Canadian poet who won the Governor's General Award for a book of poetry he did in the mid-50s, and T.S. Eliot liked the book. And then he went on and became a playwright in the 60s and got very involved in writing this book with McLuhan through most of the 60s. So, we're going to do page 149, so let's hear it.
Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce approach, since it is a kind of recap of natural processes, whether of making sense via cognition or making a house by following the lines of nature.
Yeah, now it was Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce approach, and we were just talking about the James Joyce approach before, right? The miming of the drama of cognition and the stages of apprehension and the creative process, all that can summed up as a mimetic view of cognition, that you mime the senses, the data outside you, your senses take it in and convert it and then represent the world's image with a slight alteration by your cognitive process. That's the mimetic view of cognition. I don't think LaRouche would agree with that. He doesn't take a mimetic view of cognition. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, it's the Aristotelian, not the Platonic idea. Platonic idea is everything comes from thought, which is sort of non-sensory or not limited to sense. So, Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce approach, since it is a kind of recap of natural processes, whether of making sense via cognition or of making a house by following the lines of nature. So he's saying that what humans make, a house or making sense, we're following and miming the lines of nature, the data about us. So we're miming it, and that's the Aristotelian theory of cognition. And so it's like James Joyce came after Aristotle, but McLuhan, making you think, reverses the statement. He says Aristotle confirmed what Joyce did. It's sort of like the effects preceding the causes, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce is the cause, and Aristotle is the effect. Or vice versa, Aristotle is the cause, and Joyce is the effect. But Aristotelian mimesis confirms. So that also could mean that if you're an Aristotelian and agree with Aristotle, then you have Aristotle backing up what Joyce is doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like citing a scientific precedent. Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce, or agrees with the James Joyce approach, since it itself is a kind of recap, a miming of natural processes, whether of making sense, that's the drama of cognition literally, via cognition, whether of making sense via cognition, or of making a house by following the lines of nature. Remember I said that art is defined as making. Science is more matching. All right, so making, the emphasis on making sense and making a house, knowing that your house should follow the lines of first nature as you make a second nature artifact called a house. All right?
Right.
So then we go to the next quote from the same book, page 150. You want to read that?
Biogenesis say today that a growing organism at every point in its growth has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. The consequences of the images are the images of the consequences. The involvement and polarity.
Disinvolvement.
This involvement and polarity. Knowing and growing is both creative and destructive.
Right. Now, this is another way of talking about the Aristotelian mimesis. It's the consequences of the images, or the effects of the images, are the images of the consequences. When sensory data, the world imposes its impressions through one of the senses on you, your image of what has happened to you is a product of the bias of the sense that took it in. It's another way of saying the medium is the message. The medium is determining your the way you see the artifact,
yeah,
or the world. So the effects of the images are the images of the effects.
Hmm.
And then he clarifies that by saying this is actually a dialectic between involvement, sensory involvement, and polarity or detachment, or knowing and growing. Knowing would be the polarity, growing is the involvement. And it's both creative and destructive. You take in the world, you break it up, and then remake an image, that's your part of it, and then you interact with the world. Yet you have to be careful. This is where the Joycean detachment comes in. Your making of the world is determined by the external input that came in.
Mm-hmm.
You have been molded, even though you are altering it.
Right.
So biogeneticists say today that a growing organism, at every point in its growth, has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. That's like saying effects precede causes. You know what you're trying to grow, and in the process of growing it, you know what the cause is going to be, and therefore you are miming the effects that lead to that.
Yeah.
So,
and this is probably where cybernetics, the theory of cybernetics comes into play too.
Right. So one would say that cybernetics and those thought forms that came in, cognitive studies became a big branch, you know, after World War II, in different fields. The Macy Conference studied the process of cognition to help make their computers. You know,
yeah.
Like Turing came up with the idea that you could make something that was just as intelligent as humans, and you couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be based on studying the cognitive processes. So it's evolved over the last 50, 60 years. And I was going to say, you were saying, yeah, so cybernetics. Now, here's what McLuhan would say. Once in the electric age, you can only take an Aristotelian approach to reality because you're inside a non-visual, multi-sensory environment. Therefore, the miming or the impinging of the media on you is more obvious than it was in the 18th and 19th century to visually biased people who thought that they were exerting will on the environment and were not molded by it. That was the detached bias of the visually enhanced person. But once you get into the tactile electric age, the sensory... the obvious molding and programming of yourself becomes more apparent, and so that notion, which is a product of the electric environment, inspires people to have a new approach to cognition, and we call that cybernetics, right? And all the studies that came out of that. They basically were working with the idea that the medium is the message, which is an Aristotelian point of view, and LaRouche objects to that because he's conceptually a Platonist, but LaRouche may not successfully, if McLuhan is right, be dealing with the inevitable fact of the 20th century that it leans toward Aristotle, not Plato, because we're in a multi-sensory environment which is very hard to have visual detachment on, and LaRouche represents an effort to have visual detachment, even though he's not limited to the British bias of visual detachment. He has a more comprehensive kinetic oral aspect to his visual detachment, but he's still trying to be detached through thought.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a mouthful.
Yep.
So the... Yeah, definitely cybernetics is a product of the Aristotelian effect of the electric environment. So the other thing about this last sentence of the paragraph we're doing from page 150 in the book From Cliché to Archetype, he says, this involvement in polarity, knowing and growing, is both creative and destructive. If you imagine the tactile organ incorporating different sensory data, it's got to deal with sight, sound, movement, smell, all the different sensory inputs. And as it absorbs it, it then's got to drop it and move on to the other sensory form and then, you know, deal with the sight and then deal with the sound. So you can imagine the brain doing this, you know, light speed, but it's both creative and destructive. It's forming and then dropping and moving on. It's like the one and oh of computer reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The on and off. The digital dialectic happening at very hyper speed. So... that's part of what he's describing here, the tactility. So where he says, biogeneticists say today that a growing organism, at every point in its growth, has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. The whole organism would be like the tactile view. So it has to be in touch with tactility, or whatever that is, the mystery of tactility. So the consequences of the images are the images of the consequences. So if that's true, part of the tactile process is to disconnect from the media hypnosis, from the sensory involvement, so it can move on to the other jobs it has to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very awkward way of discussing how the brain's talking, but trying to get at something. So then he says, therefore, this involvement of the consequences of the images are the images of the consequences. That involvement and polarity, knowing and growing, is both creative and destructive. It's both involved and detached. And McLuhan said the way to be in the 20th century is to be involved and detached. And he implied that that's the way people are forced to be, because so many technological changes come into societies that they're identified with something and then it's upset and the rug's pulled out and a new environment's there and they got to adapt to that. That eventually makes you slightly detached from the involved process. Because
mm-hmm.
Slower times before in history, people weren't aware of what they're being molded by because they weren't being shocked out of it fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he gives away, he goes into this in the next quote. So this is from the book Cliché to Archetype, or From Cliché to Archetype, page 152. And what's he say?
In contrast to private awareness, social consciousness is a process of scrapping, retrieving, and probing. The emphasis for the most part is upon retrieval and the accumulation of vast residues. With the development in the 19th century of many new technologies, or clichés, the supremacy of unified print consciousness gave way to multi-consciousness. There was no garbage heap, no midden heap. There was no unconscious large enough to contain all of the materials generated by the breakdown of so much probing and environing.
Yeah, so in contrast to private awareness, social consciousness is a process of scrapping, retrieving, and probing. You've got the tetrad there. He hasn't developed the concept of the tetrad yet, but you've got the scrapping is the obsolescence, the retrieving is the retrieval part of the tetrad, and probing is the enhancing. He just doesn't have the flip reversing into its opposite here. But that he talks about in Understanding Media, you know, 6 years before. So he's emphasizing in the book From Cliche Archetype the retrieval aspect. That seems to be the main part of the tetradic process he's exploring and inventing. And he says, so he's emphasizing the retrieval aspect of the 20th century's information society.
Mm-hmm. So but if retrieval occurs, something must be retrieved from the unconscious, and he's saying here there's no unconscious large enough to contain.
Right, and he means the conceptual unconscious. The actual unconscious is the new technologies and environments being made.
Okay.
Which we have earlier, we talked about that quote. It's page 31 in From Cliché to Archetype. If I look back, I don't know if I can find it quickly, but we already did that quote. The technologies and their environments are archetypes of the collective unconscious or of the social unconscious. Remember that?
Yeah.
So with the so the emphasis for the most part is upon retrieval and the accumulation of vast residues. With the development in the 19th century of many new technologies and their cliches from the 20th century point of view, they've been around for a long time. Also, our sensory life is cliche. We all have the senses. We had them for thousands of years. So they're kind of cliche environments. The supremacy with that development of so many technologies, the supremacy of unified print consciousness gave way to multi-consciousness and led to the technique of the suspended judgment. In management, there was no garbage heap, no midden heap, there was no unconscious large enough to contain all of the materials generated by the breakdown of so much probing and environing. The unconscious would be the previous culture's hierarchical technologies that a culture was limited to. That would be the unconscious they would fit things into. That'd be like their definition of God.
Mm-hmm.
So with so much in a seamless web of the global theater, it's really hard to have a container apparatus or a garbage heap or a midden heap.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next quote from page 158 and 159 of Cliché to Archetype.
The present probe tests cliché as the current technology and the archetypal world as the, quote, rag and bones shop of old perceptions and techniques. In the electric age, there are far too many cliches available for retrieval. The paradoxical result is the end of garbage or of, quote, rag and bones shops. As we tend to extend consciousness itself by the new technology, we probe all and scrap all in a deluge of fragments of cultures for creativity.
Yeah, now you see where he talks about the result is the end of garbage? That's another reason there's no unconscious large enough, is that everything is being processed. There is no fulcrum or remainder that becomes a standard that you fall back on since everything is in flux.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, using the word cliché, the present probe tests cliché as the current technology, so just like our senses are technology. I know McLuhan once said that we've hardly invented anything in the 20th century. He said all the major inventions that we've lived with in the 20th century were done in the 19th century or begun in the 19th century. That was the breakthrough century. So when we're refining them in the 20th century, they're like clichés. So the present probe, meaning the book, tests cliché as the current technology. In other words, it tests the notion or interpretation of the global theater as a cliché archetype process. And remember how we talked earlier about the archetypal world was the old visual space world. And so the present probe tests cliché as the current technology and the archetypal world as the rag and bone shop or garbage dump of old perceptions and techniques. Now the archetypal world is going to disappear because there is no garbage because everything becomes a cliché. So therefore, So there's no archetype, so what is the archetype, which would be just a particular culture's unconscious? The new archetype is understanding how archetypes are made, or understanding that technologies are unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like saying
so the technology seems to transcend and envelop the biological unconscious.
Yeah, and it's like when he says that technologies are an extension of the central nervous system. Some people think the brain is the central nervous system, and they might think the unconscious is in the brain. So all technologies are an extension of the central nervous system or of the unconscious,
mm-hmm.
which is another way of saying tactility, because tactility we're not conscious of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the electric age, there are far too many cliches available for retrieval. The paradoxical result is the end of garbage or of rag and bone shops. In other words, retrieval is obsolete, and we are probing with what would be considered old stuff, but we don't know it's not old. No, we don't know it's old, and we think it's new. And so McLuhan used to have that joke. He has it in the book, Cliched Archetype, where somebody comes into the antique shop and says, anything new? What's new today? Or anything new? What's new? They think they're going to get new stuff in an antique shop. But the Global Theater is an antique shop where nothing is antique. So there's nothing old under the sun. Used to be nothing new under the sun. But the Electric Global Theater turns everything into a situation where there's nothing old under the sun. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying here. In the electric age, there are far too many cliches available for retrieval or to be regarded as garbage. So the paradox will result in the end of garbage. As we tend to extend consciousness itself by the new technology, we probe all and scrap all in a deluge of fragments of cultures for creativity. Creativity being making sense. So in our attempt to make pattern recognition, we grab onto anything.
Okay. Listen, and we've got about 5 minutes left on this side of the tape. Why don't I read the next two paragraphs, both from Cliché to Archetype, one's page 159 and the other one page 163, and then we'll comment on that and wrap up this side of the tape. Chesterton's entire vision was paradoxical because it was based on perception as process. G.K. knew that analogy was community, and that is why he was able to write what
Etienne Jean
considers one of the best books on Aquinas. Like Alice, and this is from page 163, like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the Narcissus looking glass. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. The mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience.
Yeah, now the first one, page 159, Chesterton's entire vision was paradoxical because it was based on perception as process. That's the Thomas Aquinas thing. That's the idea that beauty is not something to identify with. You're looking at the drama of cognition, perception as process. G.K., meaning G.K. Chesterton, knew that analogy was community. In other words, the metaphor was based on technology or that community was based on a shared analogy. The early 20th century discovered that that analogy was based on technology. So he knew that analogy was community, and that is why he was able to write what Etienne Gilson considers one of the best books on Aquinas. So remember, we're talking about the Aquinas view of the way the sensory process works. All right? That's what Joyce built on, and McLuhan used that.
Right.
Now, the second quote, Alice in Wonderland, Joyce pushed all the way through the Narcissus looking glass, that's private visual space. He moved from the private creative artist, Stephen Dedalus, to the Finnegan corporate image. He started to use the garbage around him as cliche probes. He saw the environments as the story of the 20th century. So the mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, that's the drama of cognition, taking in, altering, and feeding back the same image, it isn't really the same image, but taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. And he based Finnegan's Wake on Vico's cyclical view of history. So it becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. The electric age retrieves all experience because it's looking for ways to probe the present tactile extension of the human mystery of cognition, the human mystery of cognition. And so we had in the quote above where the rag and bone shop disappears, that's another way of saying that we are able to retrieve all experience as probes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a paradoxical process. So the mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, that sounds like you take in the world and you feed back the same image, but there is that altering process that goes on in the individual mind. So I don't know how we get the same image out of altering it. When we take in an image and then we create the same image, where does that altering come in? That's probably the tactile mystery part.
Yeah, the imagination.
Yeah, you see, it's like that statement, taking in and feeding back the same image, contradicts the whole thing we've been saying, that the dream of cognition is that we do make.
Well, the thing is that you've already got an unconscious full of preconditioning. So when you take in an image, you've got to filter it through all your storage, all the stuff you've already stored. And so you're going to mutate it.
Look at the next quote. The whole of Finnegan's Wake, including the title, is paradox, based on what Joyce considered man's greatest invention, the mirror of language. So it's not a visual mirror. Any medium is a mirror. The magazine wall, in quotes, of memory and all human residue. McLuhan says that tribal societies don't have an unconscious. Visual space societies have an unconscious. And in the 20th century, we don't have a collective unconscious. We have a collective consciousness. Now, you need to clarify that, because the very process that makes tribal societies have a collective conscious and not have an unconscious is a hidden effect of the speech environment. Whereas the hidden effect of the visual environment is that it makes people think and act with an unconscious. So there's a lot of paradoxes in there we'll have to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you talk about the biological unconscious, I think you're still using terms that are part of our second nature unconscious. We don't know what the biological unconscious is. We have previous cultural images, way back Egyptian stuff that we filter through today, but that is... those images we have in Egypt or any culture that we claim are in our unconscious were made by humans. It's not a biological unconscious if we think of biological as something given to us by something that we didn't create, maybe like the genetic operation in that. So all of our unconscious is, like McLuhan says, archetypes of the social unconscious or the non-biological, even though the idea of biology is a man-made invention.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pattern we project. So we are filtering